As I said, we'd be back. It's a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. You can check us out on the web, Taylor-Report.com, for previous broadcasts. Speaking of previous broadcasts, I want to tell you that last week we interviewed Jim Dann, who has written a memoir of the Freedom Summer of 1964, in which Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney were martyred, but it was a great moment in world history, actually, the struggle for human rights. It had a shock effect around the world. And I wanted to mention that subsequently, Jim Dann was in touch with a message that there is an excellent book called Stranger at the Gate by Tracy Sugarman, which he highly recommends. If you want to know what happened during the Freedom Summer, Tracy Sugarman, Stranger at the Gate. And we are joined now by Zafar Bengay. Zafar, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
How are you? Thank you very much for taking the time.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
Zafar, we've had a speech, a very important one, from the president of Syria.
Yes.
His country is besieged by all kinds of problems.
Right.
And he has gotten a very unsympathetic response from the capitals of London, Paris, and the United States.
Yes.
Have you had a chance to look at that speech? And what do you think about his points in the speech?
Yes, I have had a look at that speech in which he basically outlined the challenges that Syria faces. And he identified the people that are involved in creating mayhem in Syria as being predominantly outsiders and supported and financed from outside. This, I think, had been well known for quite a while. Mm-hmm. There is documentary evidence available of this, and in recent days there have even been reports in the British press, particularly in the Guardian newspaper, that has identified these foreign mercenaries that are in Syria. And so basically what Bashar al-Assad did was to identify these people. Then he assured his friends and supporters that contrary to the demands that are being made that he should leave power, he said that he was not going to leave power, that he would stay. Mm-hmm. And he offered a solution to the problems in the country. He offered to have a national dialogue conference with all the groups. He did not put any preconditions on that. And he said that this dialogue conference should come up with proposals for the future. And whatever is agreed through this dialogue conference would be put to a referendum so that the people of Syria would have an opportunity to express their opinion, following which there will be elections in the country, and mm-hmm. So that this problem that has been imposed upon Syria can be resolved through political means rather than the military option that is being imposed from outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I think overall it was a very balanced speech, and he did not rule out negotiations or discussions, and he did not impose any preconditions. And yet, as you said, this has been immediately rejected by Western capitals and rulers over there in London and Paris and Washington, D.C., as mm-hmm. if they have the right to
yes.
determine what sort of a government should exist in Syria.
Yes. By the way, this is Zafar Benguys, crescent-online.net, and we are discussing the developments in Syria, and particularly the speech by President Assad yesterday. Zafar, I was struck by something, and I noticed people who follow his politics closely, the leadership of President Assad, said that the speech was in a much more vernacular, direct language than would ordinarily be the case. And one thing he highlighted was that I was struck by was he said, I'd like to know who these people are that we're supposed to talk to.
Yes, exactly.
He said, I don't ever, what are their ideas?
Yeah.
What is their politic? What is their program? He said, you know, we can't negotiate with nothing.
Yes.
We have to, you're supposed to actually, it's supposed to have content.
Yes.
But he said, they talk as though I'm supposed to discuss things with people who are murdering people.
Yeah.
Blowing up buildings and who say they won't talk to me.
Yes.
He said, do they have any ideas?
Yeah. Exactly. You see,
and do they, by the way? I can't, for my own part, when I try, I don't see any programmatic statements.
No, none whatsoever. In fact, a couple of months ago, when the UN Arab League envoy, Lakhdar Ibrahimi, had proposed a ceasefire during the Eid al-Adha holidays, the Syrian government said, we are absolutely prepared to accept that. Some of the political factions in Syria said, we would accept it as well. But then these different groups, armed groups that are operating in Syria, they said, we don't accept this ceasefire. And so if, let's say, one local commander in one area accepted the ceasefire proposal, another commander a few blocks away rejected it. So
And might kill him.
Yeah, exactly.
there seem to be professional killing going on among them involving looting.
Absolutely. In fact, in the city of Aleppo, which is the commercial center of Syria, these armed gangs and thugs are basically indulging in a looting spree. They have even killed some of the commanders there who apparently happened to grab some resources that other groups felt they should have had. So they've been fighting amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. And this is becoming much more widespread now. That these various groups, and there is essentially a patchwork of warlords that are operating in Syria. Every block is under the control of a different warlord, and whosoever has the largest amount of guns or bullets or food, then people congregate towards him because they need food and guns and bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of mayhem has gripped many of the major cities in Syria, although a few weeks ago when there was an attempt by these groups to try to create mayhem in Damascus, the capital city, then the Syrian army launched a counteroffensive, and these people were driven out of there. So in most of the cities, now the Syrian army is in control, except for some neighborhoods here and there where there may be snipers sitting on rooftops, etc.
Mm-hmm.
What this indicates is that previously when it was being reported in the British and American press, etc., that the government forces are losing control of territory and the rebels are in control of large swaths of the country. It was only marginally correct. In fact, this was a deliberate strategy of the government not to defend vast open areas, but to regroup its military into the major urban centers and ensure that the government can maintain and control those urban centers, as well as keep the roads open to most of the airports.
Mm-hmm.
2-3 days ago, in fact, there was an article in Counterpunch, this website, mm-hmm. Patrick Coburn, who had been to Damascus, and he said that he traveled from Damascus to the Lebanese border, and along that stretch of road, which takes about 2.5-3 hours, he said he traveled absolutely freely. There were no rebel forces anywhere. And he said that as soon as he reached Beirut, he received a call from one Syrian expatriate who was living in Beirut. And he said that he was extremely angry with me for saying that the government forces are still in control, that the government is not about to fall, etc. He said, "You are betraying our people," and this and that. So Patrick Coburn turned around to him. He said, "Well, look, if you are so concerned about your compatriots, why are you spending your time in a cafe in Beirut? Why don't you go to Aleppo and you know, mm-hmm. sort it out over there? I report what I see. I have no particular axe yes. to grind for any side. I just report what the truth is."
Mm-hmm.
And my reading of the situation is that I spent several days in Damascus, that people go about their business quite normally, and they are getting fed up of all this mayhem that is being created yeah. by foreign mercenaries.
It is a politics of mayhem, isn't it? I mean, and it's also, to my mind, one of the matters that, and you're addressing it very well, is a matter of basic raw disinformation.
Yes, exactly.
Where, you know, the is sort of a guarantee that every day we will see a headline that is troubling to us and points us toward intervention, but
yes.
will not be based on any facts
exactly.
that I'm aware of. By the way, I want to tell everybody, this is Zafar Ben-Gash, and it's crescent-online.net. You can read excellent reading there on all these kinds of matters. And also, I should say, too, I found the speech of President Assad at globalresearch.ca, I believe it is.
Yes.
They gave the full speech.
Right.
And on this matter of disinformation, the Washington Post yesterday, I looked at them,
yes.
and they said, they report a bad speech, bad man. But then they said, if you want the speech, go to this
yes.
Link. I went to the link, and it was actually a reporter's report on the speech. They
yes.
don't seem to know what a speech is. And whereas Global Research gave
yes.
me the speech.
Exactly.
Which is, I wish every newspaper in the country would learn to do that. Just
right.
put up the speech and then we could all talk about it later.
Exactly. Let people hear the speech or read the speech and then they can make up their minds rather than sort of some guy sitting in Washington, D.C. determining for people what he has said
yes.
by distorting what he has said and then you give your own opinion based
yes.
on that, and you think that that's a fact.
They like to be like the mama bird that chews the food for the and vomits it up for the child.
Exactly.
Yes. You know, pardon the metaphor.
Earlier on, just before the New Year's Eve, mm-hmm. Some Russian officials had made certain statements in the context of what was going on in Syria, and although one of the foreign policy advisors to President Putin had said that, well, look, we are not wedded to Bashar al-Assad. I mean, this was just in the context of a much larger situation.
Yes.
Not just that, you know, he was going to say or he wanted to say that, well, we have nothing to do with him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this was misinterpreted for days on end.
Yes.
What we were reading was that, well, Russia has now washed its hands off of Assad and he's about to collapse. And
mm-hmm.
so even the Russians have realized that, you know, he has to go. And then it took the Russian foreign minister to say, well, this is utter nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
He's our ally. We are not going to abandon him. He's the president of Syria. And we have, you know, long relationships. And we really don't see how these mercenaries that are being flooded in, brought in from outside, are going to solve the problem of Syria. So
mm-hmm.
it was only after that this nonsensical claims were, you know, they stopped publishing these these kinds of reports that.
And they moved on to different disinformation.
Exactly.
They have other files full of disinformation.
Yes.
Now, by the way, this is turning into a gigantic kind of struggle between states and populations, where some of those who are seeking to break Assad's arm are somewhat in danger of breaking their own. I'm thinking of the case of Turkey.
Yes.
I'm reading that there have been demonstrations against the installation of the NATO missiles.
Yes.
And there's been a demand for an inquiry into how the Turkish pilot came to fly into Syrian airspace. And these demonstrations are not small. Can you talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, in Turkey, more than 60 to 65% of the population is opposed to the government policy on Syria. There have been many demonstrations. This is only one of them. But there have been massive demonstrations in places like Istanbul and Ankara and other places, quite aside from the fact that when the Syrian refugees started to arrive in Turkey in a province that's called Hatay province. Hatay province is an area that is populated predominantly by Alawites, which is, of course, the ruling establishment in Syria. And these refugees that came were, in fact, not welcomed in Hatay province. And there were clashes between the Syrian refugees and the local inhabitants. And the government of Turkey was forced to take these refugees away from there, from the border with Syria, and take them much further inland. But to come back to your question of demonstrations in Turkey, there have been many demonstrations. The overwhelming opinion in Turkey is opposed to the policy that the Turkish government is pursuing, and they are very unhappy with Prime Minister Erdogan, and they say that he has basically got us stuck into a quagmire. Because the early predictions that were made at the beginning of 2011 that it would only be a matter of months before the government of Bashar al-Assad would fall, and that Turkey would then become the principal power to determine exactly what kind of government Turkey should have. And the Syrian Foreign Ministry actually issued a statement a few months ago telling Turkey that they should stop behaving like the Ottoman rulers who used to determine governors and administrators for faraway provinces, that Syria is not a province of the Ottoman Empire, and that whatever is decided in Syria, it should be decided by the people of Syria, not by those sitting in Ankara or London or Paris or Washington, D.C., or even Qatar and Saudi Arabia.
Now, these issues are actually well-established fault lines in the Turkish state,
yes.
which represent great numbers of people. After all, they've had so many years of struggle over, will the military rule the country? Will there be a chance for multi-party system? These kinds of things, and they all have to do with issues such as the one you identified.
Yes.
But this is, we're speaking to Zafar Bengash of crescent-online.net. Zafar, I would be remiss if I don't ask you about this matter, which needs to be focused on, in my opinion, much more closely, particularly the United States and Canada, the use of drones.
Yes.
And particularly, I'm thinking of Pakistan, where I understand somewhere around 2,000 some people, civilians, have been killed. I'm citing the writer Jeff Greenwald, a lawyer, American lawyer, but very brilliant man. And just recently there was an attack. I think 10, 15 Pakistanis were killed. The context for that being that the President of the United States personally, we are told, supervises this.
Yes.
Is the drone warfare still going on, and is it increasing?
Yes, well, the latest attack that you referred to took place yesterday or last night, and this was in an area that is referred to as North Waziristan. North and South Waziristan are tribal regions of Pakistan that are inhabited by tribesmen that reside on both sides of the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. And you mentioned a figure of about 2,000, but there have been other figures, particularly by investigative journalism and so on. They have cited figures of up to 4,555 people, the mm-hmm. overwhelming majority of them civilians killed by drone attacks. Mm-hmm. Just for the reminder of your listeners, drone attacks started in June of 2004 when George Bush was president. And just to give you a comparison, throughout the 4 year of Bush presidency, there were 46 drone attacks carried out in Pakistan. Since Obama, this man who gave us hope and change we can believe in, and now I'm beginning to think exactly what kind of a change he was thinking about. Yeah. He has carried more than 2,000 drone attacks in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So that was, I think, the kind of change he was thinking about, that he was going to escalate drone warfare. And I think what we need to understand is that there are two policies that are now being implemented vis-a-vis U.S. military operations. I think this era of sending American boots on the ground in large numbers is coming to an end, because they see the consequences of that, or they saw the consequences of that in Iraq and Afghanistan. So the new policy that American war planners have formulated, one is that they will use increasingly special operations forces, and they will go into a target area, carry out the operation, and get out quickly so that American soldiers are not left on the ground. And the second part of this policy is this increased use of drones. These are essentially pilotless planes. Even if they are shot down, there is no loss of American life. Mm-hmm. And these people sitting in...
Yeah, so they now say that, don't they?
Yes.
I mean, the advocates say, this is good. The pilot stays home and doesn't get hurt.
Exactly. And they play it as if it's some kind of a video game. Mm-hmm. They see these images on their screen sitting in Colorado or wherever they are sitting, and all they do is just push a button and they can blow up people, obliterate people, blow up homes.
And they don't make a count, do they? We now, by the way, you notice the kind of ugly drift in America policy and policymaking. They no longer even account for who they kill or how,
exactly.
How many.
Exactly.
They say that isn't part of their business.
That's right. Or, in fact, they normally issue a bland statement saying, you know, when the heat is increases, then they say, well, we killed so many suspected militants. They always use this expression, suspected militants.
And you, by the way, you can go to the Romans to find that kind of language.
Yes,
they killed
exactly.
a bandit.
That's right.
There was a bandit killed.
Yeah. Now, you see, even when they say a suspected militant, even they are not 100% sure that it is a militant. Any person that they suspect to be a militant, it could be a two-year-old child, it could be a girl, it could be women. The overwhelming majority of people that have been killed in these drone attacks have actually been civilians. Analysis done by Pakistani journalists as well as others have said that out of all of the attacks, only 2% of those killed can be said to have anything to do with militancy. And even those were very, very ordinary foot soldiers who may be perhaps carrying food or fuel or something for others. But the rest of them, in North and South Waziristan, the area that seems to be of particular interest to the Americans, and that is the region that has come in under the most intense attacks. The overwhelming majority of the people, and I can tell you something, it is one of the most poor areas in Pakistan. The ground over there is very harsh, mostly mountainous, without vegetation. There isn't much agriculture. There isn't much water over there. People are extremely poor. They live in mud huts. When I was a child, 7, 8, 9 years old, when I was in Pakistan, I visited North Waziristan because my grandparents came from there. And I spent several weeks over there, and I was, even at that age, I was appalled at the kind of poverty that I witnessed. And I've spoken to people more recently about conditions over there, and when I asked them certain questions as to what is the condition of this, about water, any wells, any proper buildings, and so on, those who go there regularly say that conditions are virtually the same as they were 50 years ago.
So they're poor and therefore a target.
Absolutely.
It's a horrible story. Zafar, thank you very much for sharing that, particularly your own personal observations. Zafar Benkaish, crescent-online.net. Very, very grateful. Talk to you soon.
It's a great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
For Carol and Phil Conlon, this is Phil Taylor. This is the Taylor Report. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. We'll see you next week.